Hi everybody, this is Raj Mago from simpleandpractical.com, and it's a privilege for me to be interviewing today Dr. Gary Sachs. Dr. Sachs is probably well known to you if you are in the mental health field, but just to say something briefly, he was the founder of the Bipolar Clinic and Research Program at the Massachusetts General Hospital of Harvard Medical School, where he taught for many years. And he's an internationally known expert on the topic of bipolar disorder. In particular, he was the principal investigator of the National Institute of Mental Health's STEP BD program, one of the most important studies on bipolar disorder that was ever done. Thank you so much, Dr. Sachs, for agreeing to speak to us.
My pleasure.
So I wanted to, bipolar disorder, I feel, is one of the most challenging conditions that we treat. And anybody who works with patients with bipolar disorder realizes that it's not simple. It's not a simple issue of like prescribe them the medicine and then they'll be fine. It is very difficult, and we are in this for the long haul. So I feel like we need a change in our mindset and have a strategy for approaching patients with bipolar disorder in order to get good outcomes. And I've heard you talk about this. So what do you think we need to do in our approach?
Yeah, you know, Raj, the first step, and I think of this as the same for every condition, but you're right, probably for bipolar, it's even more important. And that is to begin with concordance. I'm aiming for some level of agreement. If a patient comes and they're in the pre-contemplative stage of their condition, I'm not going to convince them they should follow a treatment plan for something that they don't want treated. But if they are coming and we can agree about at least one problem that they want to deal with, then we can move along the track. And I'm happy to start with that as long as we're in sync, as long as we're in agreement that there's a condition that they want treated. I don't make them agree to any particular diagnostic label. If they want to call their condition bipolar, that's great. If they want to say they're depressed, that's fine. If they want to call their condition peanut butter, but they want to make it smoother, that's good too. And once we have that, I can move on and I can do the assessment, and I always offer a formal diagnosis. And this is another key part of it. I think it's important to establish a current and lifetime diagnosis. And again, I'm not going to twist somebody's arm to agree with it,
yeah,
but when we're finishing up the assessment, I'm going to say, so let's see, what's the highest level of agreement we have here? And it may be that the person, very easy to get people to agree that they're currently depressed.
Yeah.
And once they agree that they've had multiple episodes, then we say, okay, so your lifetime condition is that you have a recurrent mood disorder. They may or may not agree about the nature of the highs or even the existence of the highs.
Yeah.
But once we're at recurrent mood disorder, we're cooking there, because now we have concordance in at least one problem.
Yeah.
And we can talk about the risks and benefits of a variety of treatments. So I'm going to then try to formulate what I call a menu of reasonable choices that the patient can, after some education,
yeah,
They can select the one based on their personal preference.
Now, so one of the things, a couple of things that are very interesting that we got already from what you said is that one of the things we should be thinking about is what is the patient willing to accept is part of the problem? Like right away, identify that. The patient may say, I have sleep problems. And that might be the focus. So try to identify that and go with that. And number two, you are saying, don't insist on or focus on like what it is called, and try to use the patient's, maybe the patient's language or whatever the patient's conceptualization is. But what if the patient like is in denial? Like, you know, we do see patients who pretty much like feel like there's nothing wrong with me, it's my wife who thinks I have a problem. Then we are in a tougher situation.
Yeah. Well, I I'm going to have to drop back and see what is it that brought them into the clinic.
Yeah.
Is it that they were brought by their, you know, their wife tugging at their sleeve?
Yeah.
If that's the case, we're going to have a difficult time getting that patient to do anything because they're in the pre-contemplative phase.
Yeah.
So the discussion will be really about that. What would need to happen for them to agree that there was something to work on?
Right.
And if the answer is nothing, I don't have a trick. There's no pulling rabbit out of the hat there. Unless we're in agreement, everything that I put forward to the patient is going to feel to them like an insult.
Yeah.
And I don't want to go with that. But I do want to say, well, I understand you're not getting along so well at home. What's happening?
Yeah.
Let's get into the details. Let's understand if there's a possibility of something that the patient wants to improve, make better, change.
Yeah.
And once we're into that, again, I'm okay with whatever their language is. And I'm also very upfront. I would call it this, but, you know, that's a matter of probabilities and medical art. But let's discuss what we could try that might make that better.
Yeah. Now, since frequently with bipolar disorder, it's not rare to have the family members be more concerned, like if the person's hypomanic or manic, certainly, or family members have observed that in the past. How open are you to getting the having the family member sit into the session in the initial evaluation? Like, be there?
I'm completely open to it, but you know, I want to emphasize that that isn't magic. I can get a lot of family members to argue.
Yeah,
it's much more important to me to say, you know, I've heard that you're not getting along.
Yeah,
what's going on?
Yeah,
right. So if it could be that the guy's boss is an idiot.
Yeah.
Well, when we really talk about it, it's because when he talks at work, people respond to him in a certain way, or nobody thinks his jokes are funny, and he's gotten into trouble and had to go to HR.
Yeah,
those are the kinds of things that we can explore together.
Yeah,
and it isn't like if the patient's spouse or child or parent says they have a problem, that will make them suddenly have insight. That's really not a step that I can jump over. I really have to work on the concordance first.
With the patient. So your use of the word pre-contemplatives is suggesting to us that maybe we should think about this, getting to this concordance. It's not that this model is not just for addictions, but the idea of motivational interviewing like applies to other conditions like bipolar disorder also.
Right. I think the idea of those stages, contemplative, ready, sustaining, those are transdiagnostic concepts.
Do you actually, when you're seeing patients, do you explicitly think to yourself, this person is in the pre-contemplative state, he's in the contemplative state? I mean, do you actually use that like as a tool?
Well, you know, one of the things that I try to do is use a kind of pre-assessment that includes the five-factor inventory, the personality inventory that, again, this is not threatening because it doesn't make a DSM diagnosis.
Yeah.
And it's very helpful to be able to show a patient the results because it's not a matter of interpretation. This is something that can say, you know, I see that your openness is low, your agreeability is low, your conscientiousness is low. What do you think, right?
Yeah.
And if the person says, that really is accurate to me, well, how is that going to play into our work together? And I think it is very helpful. I don't use terms like pre-contemplative, but I will use terms that are related to the domains of neuroticism, extroversion, openness, agreeableness, and conscientiousness.
Right. I meant like pre-contempt, thinking about in your own mind, this person is in such and such stage. So the five-factor personality inventory, that is a self-rated questionnaire that you have the patient do?
That's right.
And can you do that, like even if the patient is currently like hypomanic or depressed, like currently symptomatic?
Yeah, I mean, we did that in step at a couple of different time points at entry and then when the patients were well. And of course, there are differences, but the similarities are really there. And the important thing is not that I'm going to say that this is some ironclad statement we can make about, Mr. Smith.
Yeah.
He better buy into it. It's that, this is clearly how you see yourself relative to how the general population sees themselves. Yes. What do you think about that? How should we incorporate that in the plan? And I really do find that's a useful discussion to have.
Right. Okay. And is this inventory? How can our listeners who are clinicians, how can they obtain a copy of the five-factor personality inventory? Is it copyrighted, or they can just?
Yeah, I mean, they could search for Costa McCrae's paper, and they can get it from there.
All right, I'll put a link.
The most studied scales that there is, and you know, it's not difficult to get your hands on it.
All right. If it's not copyrighted, I'll put a link to it on the website.
Okay.
So that's how you start with like trying to identify like where is the patient currently, what is he concerned about, but how do you then move on to building this collaborative relationship?
Well, I think it's really important that we have started from this point of agreement.
Yeah.
And then I will explain to the patient that we're going to work together by trying to establish this menu of reasonable choices, where my job is to lay out for them, beginning with the proven treatments,
yeah,
and whatever else I know about them, the best option. So I will always offer somewhere between, you know, it's always more than one. So let's say 2 to 5,
yeah,
and it's usually 3.
Right.
So I will lay out the 3 options that I think, based on everything I know, yeah, looking backwards,
yeah,
what is the best option? Yeah. And I will let them exercise their preference, where I'll use a very straightforward teaching aid to show them the risks and benefits of each treatment.
Yeah.
And I'll let them select.
Right.
And I'll help them understand that no matter what they've selected, the magic isn't that I've picked it for them.
Yeah.
It's that instead of looking backwards, we're now going to start to look forward. Because when we look backwards, we're using not just retrospective information, but we're constructing that menu of reasonable choices based on population studies,
yeah,
right?
Yeah.
The things in the literature that may or may not really be 100% pertinent to an individual patient.
Right.
But when we go forward, then we're really personalizing the care to them.
Right.
And so that Janus kind of process, where we start out looking backwards,
yeah,
and then we look forward, the prospective outcomes means that we're going to be integrating measurement into the management.
Right.
So I've been, you know, working with patients for a long time, where I start out with a kind of benchmark for their depression and mood, yeah, elevation scores.
Yeah.
Then I can see, no matter what they've chosen, whether it's working or not.
Right.
So, and, you know, you mentioned before, I just want to come back to what is, I know, a really important point for the audience. What if the patient wants to do something that's, you know, really far out? And, you know, I don't prescribe things that I don't necessarily have confidence in.
Yeah.
But if the patient said, you know, doctor, you know, the thing that I want to do is vitamin D and omega-3 fatty acids. Well, you know, first of all, you can do that on your own. But let's at least incorporate the measures. Because,
yeah,
if that works for you, God bless you. You're going to be really happy. I'm going to pat you on the back. But let's see. And if 2 weeks or 4 weeks goes by and you're really not doing well, then we'll reconsider the menu of reasonable choices. Right.
Right?
And so this iterative process that takes the patient to a place where either they're doing well or we're following their numbers, just as I would follow their blood pressure, right?
Yeah.
If they said, you know, doctor, I don't believe in medicine. I'm going to handle my hypertension by diet and exercise. I'd say, go to it. And every time you take their blood pressure, you see that not only is it not changed, but they haven't lost any weight.
Yeah.
They really haven't done that much in the gym.
Right.
They'll try it again, and then they'll say, well, what else can I do? And then we're in agreement.
Right.
And we might pursue a different, more reasonable treatment option.
That's fantastic. So that's a true collaborative empiricism, meaning empirically we are together in this journey. We're going to try whatever we are trying and see if the things that have worked in the studies are going to work for you or not.
That's right.
Right. That's what you mean by the forward looking.
Yeah, because it's based on prospective outcomes.
In that particular person.
In that person. So, you know, I don't care that, you know, what their choices happens to be not the very, you know, best treatment in terms of the highest rates of efficacy. Yeah. If it works for them, they're happy.
Yeah.
But I also don't get into doing things that are not, you know, at least comfortable for me using my medical judgment. So if somebody said, you know, doctor, I need medical marijuana, if that didn't fit, then I'm not doing it, right? And I don't prescribe cocaine.
And, yeah.
Right?
Yeah. So that's why you call it a menu of reasonable choices. I just love that term, meaning that there is a choice. There are choices. There usually are choices, but they have to be reasonable choices.
Exactly.
So what do you think, like, why are clinicians broadly, do you think that clinicians broadly are using this kind of collaborative approach? And if they are not, what is the main barrier? What can our clinician audience do to become more collaborative, more empirical?
You know, when I talk to psychiatrists, Raj, and primary care docs about this, they often say, yeah, they do a version of this, or they'd like to do a version of this. But the main thing that gets in their way is there's not enough time.
Yeah.
They have incredible time pressure.
Yes, yes.
Right? And they say, you know, I get in there with the patient, I say, you know, Joan, how you been sleeping? And I get an answer that takes up, you know, 10 of the 15 minutes that I have, and it still doesn't tell me what I need to know. And I really have to do something for her because, you know, she's not doing well.
Yeah.
Okay, great. So, you know, I think that is a huge barrier, that time pressure.
Yeah. So what would be some small steps that we can take to overcome this? I know you have given this matter a lot of thought.
Well, in my practice, I have patients do this pre-assessment online, which I can review very quickly before they come in. So we shift this measurement part outside, and I can review in a, you know, very short period of time, meaning 20 seconds, something that it's taken the patient 20 to 30 minutes to do, and then I can actually talk to them, and it's very useful. Now, you may not have an online system in every practice, but you can certainly have the patient do paper forms if you need to, and they can bring them and they can show them to you when they arrive.
Right.
It will save an enormous amount of time, and it will give you a lot of the same answers. There's a huge advantage to shifting things outside the visit.
Right. So before they, on their own time, they should come in already ready with like a depression questionnaire or a sleep questionnaire or whatever is needed, or mood charting and so on, which we can't go into details today, but there should some kind of assessment online or on paper that they do prior to the visit. And then I guess that would also help long term, because if you do the same questionnaire over a long period of time, you can track the progress.
Exactly. For me, you know, the system I use puts a graphical representation of their longitudinal course together.
Yeah.
As we proceed through months and years,
yeah,
that's extremely valuable to me. Right. And it is to the patient, too. If somebody moves, they can take this with them. It's portable.
Yeah.
So this idea of displaying information visually in a way that makes it very, very easy. I think the problem with paper scales is often, oh, I've got to read them and score them, and you know that can take time. So you need to be a little bit careful about what you do. But I would say even the simplest measure, right? Blood pressure, temperature, pulse, those are extremely simple measures. And most primary care docs now have somebody else do that for them before they sit down with a patient. If you have a way to do that, it's greatly advantageous to the clinical process.
Right. Great. And I hope that at another time we may be able to come back and talk to you more about the process of how to do these assessments or what particular tools. But the principle is correct. So do you also involve the family member in doing these assessments? Do you get input from the family member?
Yeah, that's an option that, again, with a bipolar patient is usually extremely important compared to many other diagnoses. So, yeah, absolutely, there's a role for the patients. We call them care partners, And that'll be a family member, a friend, somebody else who knows them.
Yeah.
And in many cases, especially at the start, I encourage them to come to every visit. That may lessen over time.
Yeah.
If the patient does well, and of course, it can always be restarted if something comes up. But we have patients put together these collaborative care plans that write down what their strategies are, who's involved, and therefore I can call on these care partners whenever necessary. And I do not take patients who say, I can't talk to anybody else. I use my discretion when the patient allows it,
yeah.
But I'm perfectly okay saying I won't tell anything to anybody else, but I can't manage a bipolar patient on the assumption that if somebody says, I'm worried about John, I have to say, you know what, I wish I could tell you that I even know John, but
yeah.
I'm sorry I can't, because I think that gets everybody off on the wrong foot and often into serious trouble.
So this is also a very important point that I don't think everybody is doing. So you have the patient agree to in writing that in the future, if like his father or his wife or her husband, they call and they express concern, that you have permission to speak to that person? Is that what?
Well, so in the collaborative care plans, what the basic story is, they name care partners. Those people are actually regularly involved, as yeah. I think your first set of questions about this topic implied. But part of what is spelled out, anybody, they don't have to be named.
Yeah.
It could be, you know, the coworker, the neighbor. So, you know, if I'm going to take care of you, I need to hear if somebody else is worried about you. And I assure the patient that I'm not going to be giving information.
Right.
But I have to be allowed to receive it.
Right.
In order to take care of them.
Right. I guess that, yeah, with bipolar disorder, that is particularly important. And it's good to spell this out like early in the treatment.
That's right.
And lastly, you know, let me ask one more question and then we'll stop, is that in terms of educating the patient, so I guess bipolar disorder is a little bit like diabetes, like a chronic illness, and so education is a big part of that. Are there particular websites, books, or other things, that tools that you use to educate patients with bipolar disorder?
Yeah. You know, we used to we still have resources listed on our website for patients to go to. And we used to talk about those things quite a bit. Now, I really find patients have already consulted Dr. Google before they come.
Right.
And it's usually a matter of me asking them if they have questions about what they've read, and making sure that they know that I'm available if there are issues that come up, things that they're concerned about, if I see something that is a potential misunderstanding that they yeah. may have. We can talk about that proactively.
Yeah.
But I will tell them that education is a big part of this, and the more they know, the better. So there are links on our website. They can use resources. But, you know, these days, I don't think it's a matter of saying you should read this book or this article. Patients have great access to
right, education. Right. But your point is actually very important, which is that doctors should proactively ask, hey, what have you read on the web, or what is your understanding
about this condition? What's your? I always ask a patient what their understanding is.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
And you know, it's fascinating to hear.
Yes. Yes. I did a survey of patients about their internet use, yeah. And in my survey, every single person said, my doctor has never asked me about this. So they were doing it on the side. And yeah. They were not telling their psychiatrist, and the psychiatrist was not asking. So this is, you know, this is an important point that you have emphasized, that we should be very aware that patients are looking things up. Now, Dr. Sachs, before we go, you had mentioned the website that has some resources. Can you share with us the website so that our listeners can go to that website?
Yeah, you know, they can see the resource on the site. They can just go to engagedpractice.com.
engagedpractice.com, and I'll put a link to it on my website as
sure.
well. So thank you very much, Dr. Sachs, for talking to us and giving these pithy, like I would call them, pearls of wisdom, which I hope that our clinician listeners will incorporate, and we'll all continue to work on trying to get better outcomes for our patients.
Well, thanks. It's been a pleasure talking to you, Raj.
Thank you.